From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the program, longtime Senator Carl Levin joins us for a conversation about his decades of public service, from Detroit City Council to the U.S. Senate.
My mother, she said, you know better than anybody else, that nobody else is better than you, and never forget it.
Levin has a new memoir telling the story of his boyhood in Detroit on through nearly four decades in the nation's capital. Then we bring you a personal story of fascinating family history from West Michigan, an organic farmer who's continuing a legacy of Black families working the land.
If you want to hold on to a legacy, if you want to, you know, pass on wealth or wealth creation, you know, make sure you do everything you can to hold on to the land that you have.
Those conversations coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This hour, we meet a Black organic farmer from West Michigan continuing a family legacy in agriculture.
Black farmers have lost land and lost property at, you know, at one point, like in the 1920s, there were 16 million acres of land being farmed by Black farmers, and now it's less than 3 million acres that they're farming. And so you see the decline in just being able to hold on to those lands.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, former United States Senator Carl Levin solidified that Levin name in federal-level politics over 36 years that he spent in Washington, D.C. Levin is retired from office and has been a distinguished lecturer in residence at Wayne State University's law school in his hometown of Detroit. It is from his home and retired life in Michigan that he composed his new memoir, Getting to the Heart of the Matter, My 36 Years in the Senate. And joining us now is Carl Levin. Senator, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, it's great to be with you.
One of the things that's so enjoyable about the book is the stories that you have to tell about so many iconic people that you met. Because of your work on the Senate Armed Services Committee and Homeland Security and the Select Committee on Intelligence, you were one of the faces sometimes representing the U.S. government abroad. And you talk about, you know, meeting Henry Kissinger, working with Anwar Sadat, stories about then-President Reagan, and just really too many world leaders to list. It's kind of a reminder that the world of governing is a bit of a small circle. Everybody kind of knows everybody else, and relationships are frequently in play. Could you talk about what your approach was to talking with people who were working in top levels of government when you had to negotiate, or if you were simply fact-finding?
You know, it was such a treat and so important to meet with people like Anwar Sadat. Here's a guy who put his life on the line. He knew it when he signed the Camp David Accords with Israel, recognizing Israel. And when I met with him, I asked him, and I was lucky enough that he would give me a full hour of his time, just one-on-one. I asked him, I said, you know, your life has been threatened many times. You did something with recognizing Israel, which has created great danger of people who are out to kill you because of what you did. How come you're able to seem so peaceful? How are you able to talk so calmly and to sort of emanate a peaceful attitude and demeanor? And he said it was his Muslim religion which allowed him to do that. And I think of people who are anti-Muslim and the stereotypes which are created and drawn by some people about other people, including Muslims, and how unfair it is and how divisive it is for those stereotypes to be passed along frequently through the social media, and how important it is that people try to ignore stereotypes that they hear about, not base their attitudes towards other people and other groups based on a stereotype.
I don't think a person spends 36 years in the U.S. Senate without gaining a deep understanding of how relationships among legislative colleagues can work. Can you think of an example in which something got done that had a a real benefit in the lives of folks at home in Michigan that wouldn't have otherwise happened without the relationships that you developed over your time in office?
Well, I had a really wonderful relationship with a number of Republicans, including John McCain, John Warner. One example, for instance, with McCain was we had a hearing looking into tax abuses by the most profitable companies in the country that were not paying taxes at all or paying reduced taxes because they created these artificial entities overseas in tax havens so that they could avoid paying American taxes. Well, you got the wealthiest companies, the Googles, the Apples, and so forth, that are avoiding taxes. That puts a burden on the rest of us to keep the government's revenues going. And that includes, obviously, people in Michigan. It's not just a Michigan benefit. It's a national benefit, but it surely includes taxpayers in Michigan who have a tax burden, and we should not be carrying that burden for the wealthiest among us, including those corporations. And so McCain took a very gutsy position. He went after the president of Apple at a hearing with me in our oversight hearing at Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And he took him on with me. And, you know, if for a Republican to take on a big corporation on a tax issue because they're not paying taxes at all or enough, their share, is a courageous thing for McCain to do. And he was a courageous guy generally. So I had a number of very good relationships with various Republicans that work with me on a permanent subcommittee and were with me when I was chair of the Armed Services Committee.
Can we turn back for a moment to the time in which you were getting involved in politics? You were raised in Detroit, of course, the grandson of immigrants. And you say in the book that your family always talked politics at the dinner table, that lively discussion was just something your family did. You don't make any mention about how your mom felt about you and then eventually your brother Sandy ascending to these national offices. Do you think that that's something that she and perhaps your late father, like what they would have thought of that?
Well, my mother and dad were both deeply committed to public service. They were strong Democrats and believed in FDR, and my dad was very active in public life in a number of ways. My mother was she sort of accepted what came. She was more philosophical about life. She taught us about equality. She said, "You're no better than anybody else, but nobody else is better than you." And never forget it.
You spent several years working for Michigan's Civil Rights Commission. And then, as you say, catalytic times inspired you to think about public office. Could you tell us about where you were when the uprising happened in 1967?
Yes, I was the chief appellate defender at that time for the defender's office in Detroit. I lived in Detroit. We always have lived in the city and still do. We live downtown. We were representing indigents, representing people who were arrested during that uprising. It was very different from the riot in 1940s, mm-hmm. Because it was not a race riot the way it was in the 40s in Detroit. We have lived in a biracial neighborhood. I remember standing and watching with our neighbors, both races, as the looting was taking place on a nearby street, and it was a very devastating occurrence, obviously, for the people who were involved and people whose businesses were destroyed, and for the city's image and future set us back a long time. But we're roaring back now. The last few years have been wonderful to see in Detroit. We just are coming back so strongly, this city. It's an amazing, wonderful thing to see, and something I always had believed would happen, and did whatever I could as a member of the Senate to boost that comeback.
After those several years in Detroit City Council, then you did go on to the Senate in 1978. You tell a spectacular story from one of your trips overseas in the 1980s, with a guy who at the time was your Senate colleague, but who is now the President of the United States. Can I ask you to share the conversation you saw Joe Biden have with the man who was then the second in command in the Soviet Union, Alexei Kosygin?
Well, we were new senators in 79 or 80 he took us, and Biden invited us to join him as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee to go to Russia to meet with Russian leadership. You know, we sat around this table with Kosygin, head of the Communist Party, I believe at the time, number two anyway. And we, you know, first heard from Joe as the leader of our delegation. I think there were four or five of us. And then Kosygin responded. And his response was just total Soviet propaganda. And Joe, being the blunt and direct guy he is, in response to Kosygin, said something like, well, we have an old saying in Delaware, you can't bullshit a bullshitter, which he shortened it to, you can't BS a BS guy like me. I know how to BS, and I know when I see it. And so afterwards, I asked the interpreter, you know, how did you interpret that into Russian? And her answer was, you can't fool a comrade. And I looked at her and said, wow, yeah, that's not what he said, but I guess you softened it for the diplomatic purposes. But at any rate, Biden was great then. He's great now. He's a direct guy. He combines a sense of humor with deep beliefs and things that I think most Americans believe in, which is the needs and rights of everybody, equal protection under the law of all groups. People ought to have opportunity. We ought to deal with poverty and racism. And he's genuine. He's authentic. That's something about Joe Biden which people crave, I think, even if you don't like him. He's authentic. He's real. And people want that in their public officials.
Coming up, more from my conversation with Senator Carl Levin. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We continue now our conversation with longtime U.S. Senator Carl Levin, now retired. He has a new memoir published by Wayne State Press entitled Getting to the Heart of the Matter, My 36 Years in the Senate. Having the background that you do, coming from Detroit and having worked on civil rights and affirmative action issues and so many related things for so long, can you say a few words about what it meant to you to see Barack Obama elected president?
Well, I was with Barack Obama in the Senate, so I knew what kind of a guy he is, which is another authentic, smart, decent guy. It was very, very meaningful to me to see him personally, because I knew him and know him as a person and his wife. My wife, Barbara, and his wife, obviously his Senate spouses then, came to know each other too. And at any rate, the election itself was the most exciting election that I'd ever participated in, a presidential election, since President Kennedy. When President Kennedy was running, I was active in his campaign. There was tremendous excitement about John Kennedy as a candidate. The crowds were huge, and the feeling was really strong that he could make a difference for our country. And the excitement about young people for John Kennedy at that time was great. I felt great being part of it. But the 08 election with Barack Obama was, after the Kennedy election, the most exciting election that I participated in my life. And I watched young people get involved who had not been involved before. And so it was a magnificent moment, I thought, for the country to elect the first African-American, but also somebody who genuinely believed that all people should have a fair opportunity. He was a guy who does not stereotype, who knows how to compromise to get things done. I saw that in the Senate, where he worked across the aisle with Republicans to get things done for the country. And I was confident he would do the same as president, which is exactly what he did.
Do you think that his time in office improved America's attitudes on race?
Yes, I do. Even people who are still racist or still bigoted, and some of those surely existed. And the most recent ex-president, Trump, surely exploited that. Mm-hmm. That feeling on the part of many divided us along those lines. But there was definitely an improvement, a step forward in terms of race in America and the need for people to see others as human beings. And so Obama's, obviously his election didn't eliminate racism. That's a long-term process, but we've made some important steps, and that election was won.
There are a lot of things that are hard to understand about the last 4 years, but I think one that is really hard for many people is understanding what happened in the Senate while Donald Trump was president. As somebody who has a great love for the Senate as an institution, can you shed any light on the way that Senate Majority Leader McConnell, what he was doing in the Senate and the way he was using power during the time that Trump was president?
Well, I think he was appealing to a Republican base and would do anything in order to keep Republican control, including some things which were highly divisive in terms of achieving national goals. And he took some very rigid ideological positions from a right-wing perspective. I think he was doing that for political purposes because he thought that doing so would maintain a Republican base, which he felt then was the key to maintaining the Senate in the Republican majority. But he's very political. On the other hand, I think he does respect the institution. The institution itself, he used the so-called nuclear option to arbitrarily and against the rules and the filibuster, and that resulted in some Supreme Court judges, which would not have been confirmed if he hadn't violated the rules. But in fairness to McConnell, and I have very deep differences with McConnell, he didn't start that. We started that as Democrats when we ignored the rules to get some district court judges confirmed. And, of course, the reason that was done was because the Republicans were able to, just by threatening to filibuster, prevent those nominees of Barack Obama to the district courts to be voted on and confirmed. But that also was partly our fault because we failed. We Democrats failed to force the people threatening to filibuster to actually filibuster. And that was our shortfall because too many of us, and understandably, didn't want to give up weekends and nights and watching our kids play soccer and so forth. We were unwilling to give up our own lives, basically, in order to force the Republicans to carry out the threat, which they would not have done, I believe, on district court judges. So it was frustration with the Republican threats of filibuster, but which we allowed to succeed by not forcing them to carry out the filibusters, that triggered then the frustration that we understandably had and our majority leader understandably had with Republicans thwarting votes on Obama's district court nominees. But then that was the precedent to do what the Democrats, you know, had previously done. That mm-hmm. led to the Supreme Court judges getting confirmed.
Right. Given everything that's happened and the tone in the Senate right now, do you think if you were a younger man, you would still be interested in serving there?
Oh, absolutely. It's the greatest place that I can imagine, other than a presidency, to be involved in public service, which is so important that people respect and understand and I think honor by the way in which they practice their public service and get engaged looking for the good of the cause or the state or the district, and not after just always trying to do what's popular, which is a way of assuring one's own reelection. And that shouldn't be the motive. It shouldn't be doing the popular thing. It should be a willingness to, after thinking about it, listening to people, not being arrogant, doing what you think is best for your district, if you're elected official, or your state. But there's so many forms of public service. It's not just elected public service. There's 100 different ways that people can serve their communities. And I think this country is so, the foundation in a way, is helping each other, respecting each other, serving each other, sacrificing for each other, being part of a community. We talked about family before, which is number one in my book, but community is number two. Being part of a community that you are serving and helping in charitable ways, in giving, in volunteer work. There's just so many ways of really being a public servant. And this country's been famous for that kind of commitment, and I hope always will be.
Senator Carl Levin's new memoir is Getting to the Heart of the Matter, My 36 Years in the Senate. Senator Levin, thank you so much.
Good being with you, April.
The Biden administration's COVID relief package passed through Congress yesterday, and it had a little reported provision that would be of specific benefit to Black farmers. It provides about $5 billion in aid to disadvantaged farmers. About a quarter of those who qualify are Black. Over the past century, Black farmers have lost millions of acres in farmland. In 1920, they numbered nearly a million. Today, there are fewer than 50,000. Bruce Michael Wilson, who owns Groundswell Farms in Zeeland, wants to help change that. He took over the farm in 2019 and hopes to use it as both a business and as an opportunity to teach the next generation about farming and land stewardship. He joins us now. Bruce Michael Wilson, welcome to Stateside.
Hello, April.
You grew up in Allegan, a little ways outside of Grand Rapids, right?
Well, not exactly Allegan. It's Allegan County, but the town I grew up in is called Hopkins.
What made your family want to move out?
Move out to Hopkins?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know every detail as to why my family wanted to move out, but I think the basis was, you know, to move away from the city. You know, my dad came from a rural country environment in the state of Mississippi. And so when he moved to Michigan, he settled in Grand Rapids. And then he thought that it would be best for his family to be raised in a rural community, a farming community in the countryside like he was.
Allegan is a county that's mostly white and rural. Are there things that you remember about what your family found when you moved out there?
Well, you know, some stories are shared with me, I should say, by my father. Of course, I was very, very young at the time. I think I might have been 3 years old at the time. So, you know, I don't remember many things that probably took place, but I do remember some things that took place. And it wasn't necessarily an inviting place, you know, to begin with. But with all that said, it turned out to be the best thing and the best place that we could have ever moved to.
What was your favorite part about living there?
You know, I wrote a book, or I should say I wrote and illustrated a book when I was, I think, 7 years old. And I talked about growing up on the farm, and it was near and dear to my heart, still is today. And I talked about the animals that I had to take care of on a daily basis. And I spoke about nature and just the everyday life of growing up outdoors and being in touch with, you know, the river that ran through the property as well. And, you know, all the land that I could traverse and go out hunting and fishing and do all the things that an inner city kid wouldn't have the privilege of doing.
Do you still have that book?
I do still have that book, ironically. And, you know, I found it a few years ago in a pile of papers and things that my mom would keep. And it was shocking to see, because it's, you know, back then I made it a copyright, you know, and it was typed out and everything. And then I had a hardcover on it, and, you know, and I had that hardcover covered over with, you know, a nice detail. And so I was kind of shocked at what I had done back then.
That's awesome. You did not go into farming right after college. You now have a career in investing in real estate. What was it that made you want to return to farming?
You know, the farming never left my soul. I didn't go into farming, but I never left farming either, if that makes any sense. I would always come back to the farm, and I would put my time in. Even when I moved away out of state, you know, to Colorado, I would still come back every season and help my parents, you know, put in crops. We always had a large garden, you know, a large, maybe a 1 acre garden. And so, I mean, for those who don't know what an acre is, that's a sizable garden, you know. And I'd come back and help bale hay and help take care of the, you know, the cattle and the horses. And so, you know, it's never left my soul. It's never left my blood, and it's never left my DNA. So, you know, it can't be really said that I left farming.
Mm-hmm. Like you say, I mean, this was a part of your life all those years in between, but there was this moment when you realized you were thinking about coming back in person to it. What was your folks' reaction when they realized that you were thinking about this seriously?
No, truthfully, they haven't really said. I mean, I think they kind of know where my heart is, you know, and my heart was always in the land and being connected to the land and being connected to nature. And that's always been a part of me. I spent a lot of time when I lived at home outdoors and in the woods and, you know, around the birds and, you know, the deer and just out in a peaceful zone. I would spend a lot of time maybe sitting on a log or something out in the woods and kind of just taking it all in. So they always knew that about me. And so I don't think it shocked them to know that, or to see me kind of take on this endeavor. You know, I did it for a number of reasons. I think, you know, maybe if I had to name the top two or three reasons, I was really wanting to do it, you know, to kind of shine light on something where the light has just been dimmed, you know, dimmed down to a very, almost to nothing, if you know what I mean, as far as people that look like me that are out there farming, especially in Western Michigan. And it's just something that you just don't see. And so I wanted to bring that back into the forefront and just remind people that, hey, there are farmers that look like me that can do the same work and that can produce and grow and care for the land and raise vegetables and turn it into an operation, you know, and make it a worthy operation. And also it was something that I wanted to pay homage to my ancestors about as well, you know, because they've kind of been lost in this whole, you know, thing it's an unknown. You know, it's an unknown to a lot of people. You know, where farming may have actually came from, or may have actually existed, and was thought about in the new world here, as we call it, the new world. I mean, people don't realize that, you know, some of the first Africans that came over to the United States, you know, they were farmers to begin with. That was part and parcel the reason why they were sought after on the west coast of Africa anyway, because they were already natural farmers in cotton and tobacco and sugar cane and different things like that. So they had that ability already, and the Europeans knew that. So they wanted to bring them to the new world to help, you know, facilitate that once they arrived. And Black farmers have been a very important fabric of this United States, and they've actually promoted a lot of the wealth. Black farmers, along with the institution of slavery, you know, made this country the greatest wealth creation that ever existed at that time. And so I wanted to pay homage to that.
In just a minute, I'll continue my conversation with organic farmer Bruce Michael Wilson of West Michigan. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue my conversation with Bruce Michael Wilson. He's an organic farmer and the owner of Groundswell Farms in West Michigan. And he's continuing a family legacy in agriculture. You took over Groundswell Farm in 2019. Can we talk a little bit about what that felt like, what it was like to first step foot on the farm and begin preparing and planting?
You know, farming is something that I knew I could do. However, I had never tackled something of that magnitude before. You know, I had never tackled a commercial operation where you had to tend to so many different tentacles of that operation, you know, and make certain that everything is dialed in and that everybody is going to be accommodated, you know, for as far as your CSA members and your farmers markets and your accounts that you might have had with certain stores and restaurants, things of that nature. And then implementing a workforce that you didn't have, you know. Mm-hmm. When I first endeavored into it, you know, it was just me and an assistant that I had. And then I slowly added on some part-time help, but that first season was really all about what I could do. And ironically, and I know some people have even told me, they've shared with me that they didn't think I was going to make it because I purchased the farm in the middle of the season. I shouldn't say the middle of the season, but it was at the beginning of the season. But the beginning of farm season really starts now. It doesn't start in June. And I made the transaction in July, in the middle of July.
Oh, wow. What were your work days like then?
Oh, I mean, work weeks, you know, I'm talking 80-hour work weeks, work days, 16-hour work days or more. You know, it's just around the clock, and it's 7 days a week. And, you know, it's just zero time off. And, you know, I kind of knew what I was getting myself into. I knew what was going to take away from what I was doing, and I was going to lose, you know, some income from taking on this initiative. But it was important enough for me to, you know, to seek out. And so I stuck with it. And surprisingly, you know, we were a month behind as far as CSA, you know. And so what I did is, to accommodate my members, I said, you know, I'm going to promise you that I'm going to go into the first week, you know, the 1st of December, you know, because typically CSA stops at the end of October. But I promised them that I would cover them through the month of November, just to make up for that month that we were behind. And I was, you know, by the grace of God, I was able to do that. And people, I think, were shocked. And so the following year, we did even better and got a lot of compliments as far as, you know,
the quality of our vegetables. And, you know, some of the longtime members that have been with the farm for, I don't know, 15 years, they commented on the vegetables being, you know, of the highest quality they had seen since they've been members.
Mm-hmm. You only had really 1 year with this before the pandemic turned everything upside down. Could you tell us a little bit about what's been going on at the farm since the coronavirus hit and whether it's, what kind of changes it's meant to how you handle the business?
Yeah, 2 years of presumed catastrophe, you know, first year of starting late and maybe not meeting the demands of everybody, and then going into the next season with the virus. You know, and I took that on the same way I did the first year and said, you know what, I just have to retool my efforts. It was kind of a challenging process to think about what I needed to do. And that's when I started setting up e-commerce and thinking that I was going to have to go online for the most part and be able to, you know, service my customers that way. You know, people were coming to me and asking for my business, you know, and the pantries needed my business in Ottawa County. And so that was a blessing. And, you know, another company downtown Grand Rapids, Dorganics, needed my business. And so that was a blessing as well. And I was still able to service, you know, the markets too, when I wanted to. And I didn't do it to the level of that we had in the previous years, but I did service the Holland market and the Southeast market and the Saugatuck market. So this year, you know, we're going to be doing the same thing. You know, we're going to be dealing with the virus again, and we're going to be better at it this year.
Why don't you tell us a little bit more about what you grow?
You know, the farm has always had a reputation of growing very good organic, and I should say USDA certified organic. You know, it is a USDA certified organic farm. And that was another reason why I purchased it as well, is because of that label. And so we've always known to be growing very quality vegetables, about 200 different varieties of 40 different vegetables. So, I mean, we run the gamut on, you know, just about whatever vegetable you have eaten or wanted to eat. It grows on our farm, you know, even some of the things that people would say are kind of, you know, some of the not your normal type vegetables like kohlrabi and, you know, different things like that people don't eat on a regular basis. We grow those kinds of things on the farm too. And I'm happy to say that. At the same time, we need to find a way to streamline what people really want and what people can, or people want to buy, I should say, and more of, or on a regular basis, you know, because that's what makes a farm profitable too. And it also conserves the kind of space that you have to grow the things that people truly want to pay for.
Is there anything in particular that, I understand what you're saying, that the scale of this is not like a kitchen garden, but is there anything that's a particular favorite of yours to grow?
You know, I like sweet potatoes. And it, you know, and I won't say that it's my favorite thing to necessarily grow, but it's probably my favorite vegetable, you know, for a number of reasons. My grandma, her name was, they called her Sweetie. And so that kind of reminds me of her, you know, growing sweet potatoes. And I love sweet potato pie. And so my mom makes the best sweet potato pie. And so if I can grow some sweet potatoes and have her make me a pie, I mean, it's the best thing ever. Let's see, I love sweet corn as well, but I don't have the room to grow sweet corn. You know, the bicolor sweet corn is terrific. I would like to one day be able to, you know, get more space, acquire more land or property, and grow more sweet corn so that I can service the public and put away for myself.
Right. I don't know if there's anything much better in July than the sweet corn that you get right out of the field.
Oh, man, you can't beat it. You cannot beat it.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about how much you had to deal with, or maybe how much your family had to deal with, too, in terms of institutional barriers to farming? You know, for a lot of people, getting together the capital to get started on the land is just a huge and in many cases insurmountable problem.
You know, well, first of all, you have to be able to acquire the property to begin with. That's the largest hurdle and the biggest first step. And as you said in the beginning of the program, how many Black farmers have lost land and lost property at one point, like in the 1920s, there were 16 million acres of land being farmed by Black farmers. And now it's less than 3 million acres that they're farming. And so you see the decline in just being able to hold on to those lands. And so I'm just inspired by the fact that I was able to purchase this property. And I'm very much inspired by the fact that my parents still own the property that I grew up on, 160 acres and, you know, in Hopkins. And so I have heard of some barriers that my dad went through of, you know, with trying to get financing and loans to raise his crops. And, you know, there's been cases where, you know, even if he wanted to rent out his property at some point, if he didn't want to farm it, where he wouldn't be treated completely fair when it came to, you know, either price per acre or how they treated his land and so on and so forth. So, you know, there are those barriers that you have. And then you have to deal with the whole sense that of people just qualifying you. You know, you just they some people just don't believe that you're qualified to do the work because they haven't seen it before. They haven't seen Black farmers before. They don't know any Black farmers. They don't know the history of Black farmers. So they don't know that you're qualified to do it. And so you have to prove that you can do the work and produce as well as anyone else before somebody will give you a handshake. And so, you know, that's discouraging as well, is that you over and over and over again, you have to kind of prove yourself.
You know, there are some things going on at the national level that I wanted to ask you about. The chair of the U.S. House Agriculture Committee is now a Black man, Representative David Scott from Georgia. And Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow is chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee. Senator Stabenow introduced a bill called the Justice for Black Farmers Act that attempts to step up to some of the historic inequities and discrimination, you know, trying to free up access to credit, trying to make land available. I'm wondering if there are things that you'd hope to see coming out of these efforts and just what needs to fall into place to get some motion on this.
You know, I just hope it just doesn't fall on deaf ears. I just hope it's a genuine effort to really hit a home run with this thing. And, you know, there's a lot of things that have been instituted in other administrations, and they really never get off the ground. You know, we talk about the Pickford situation with the USDA back in 1999 and how Black farmers were disenfranchised as far as getting loans and financing for farms and which caused them to go into foreclosure and lose their properties and things. But, you know, that still hasn't been resolved. I mean, that, and look how many years that's been. And not to mention, there has to be some an equitable solution. I mean, $50,000 is, they might as well keep it. I mean, because you can't really do much with that going forward. I mean, so I really hope that, you know, what the new administration is doing and what our senator here in the state of Michigan is doing is really going to take a foothold and really make some progress, you know. But if there's somebody standing in the way, you know, there's always going to be somebody standing in the way of progress, especially when it comes to the needs of Black people. And so they just have to continue to put an effort into this and give some attention to this, some serious attention to this, because it's much needed, you know, because we are at the precipice of extinction. Black farmers, they may never be anymore unless people like myself, who still have an interest in doing it, can actually raise up the next generation of these guys and show them that there is a way to make a living doing it. You know, you got to make people believe that they can make a living doing it.
When you think about Black families becoming more and more scarce, having to go out of business, having to sell their land, could you tell us a little bit about what you think is lost there, or what farming does offer Black families that really doesn't come from any other kind of work or wealth acquisition?
Well, you just hit it on the head. It's about wealth creation. I mean, probably the biggest wealth creation in history is the acquisition of land and property. I mean, you see all these battles across not just this country, but across the world, and most of the time it's a fight over land, you know, the acquisition of land and being able to hold on to land, you know, and you think about it and you say, well, why is that? And because it's extremely valuable to have land. And I'm not just talking in the monetary sense. I'm talking in the sense that if you're rooted in a foundation, which is land, you can do so much with that land. There's so many multi-purpose things that can be done to basically care for your family. And one of the most important things is what I do right now is farming. That's probably one of the most important professions out there. But nobody gives it its due attention when it comes to, you know, how important farming and feeding people really is. And so I'm glad that you're putting a spotlight on, and I'm glad that there's some interest now, especially during this pandemic, that people are starting to wonder, man, you know, where am I going to get my next meal, or where does it actually come from? It doesn't just, you know, pop up in the grocery store on its own, you know? And so I'm just happy that's happening right now. Yeah, it's been tragic. I mean, you know, having property is a legacy. Having your own land can create a legacy, and that legacy is being lost by all these Black farmers that have lost all their land and property. That legacy is lost now. So that's why I encourage my family, my brothers and sisters, and my parents. If you want to hold on to a legacy, if you want to, you know, pass on a wealth or a wealth creation, you know, make sure you do everything you can to hold on to the land that you have. And, you know, and in that sense, you know, the next generation will be better off. You know, that's the thing that separates us from the white population. You know, the white population, they pass on they're able to pass on their wealth, you know, through what they own as far as property, if it's land or if it's a structure or houses. And then another thing is life insurance policies. You know, that's another way where Blacks have been left behind as far as wealth creation. So these, you know, two things in concert with one another would help, you know, kind of promote more wealth creation for the next generation of people of color.
Bruce Michael Wilson is the owner of Groundswell Farms. Bruce Michael, thank you so much for talking to us, and thanks for the work you're doing, too.
No, yeah, I appreciate it. Anytime. Thanks for, again, shining a light on this subject, and I thank you for the good work.
Are there days when you miss the show or you want to catch up after taking a break from the news? I just wanted to remind you, we've recently revamped the Stateside podcast. If you've got 15 or 20 minutes, we're giving you a compelling listen to an essential story from Michigan every weekday. We cover a lot of ground, from conversations about politics to music to stories that connect us to each other. Find the Stateside podcast wherever you listen. And don't forget to rate us and leave us a review. We're looking forward to hearing what you think. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Mike Blank, Aaron Allen, April Van Buren, Laura Weber Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. See you next time.